Well, good afternoon. That got your attention, mine too. This is the second section of modern biotechnology. If that wasn't your intent, now's the time to make a break for it. If you're in the right spot, to maximize time for each, we'll go just right immediately to Vincent Long. So I'll turn the podium over to you. Please warmly welcome him.
Okay. Thank you for attending the session, and I'm going to be talking about biotechnology. Is this a field that is actually in financial crisis? And some of the things that I'll be talking about today may shock you, so put on your safety belts. Let me start off with a story. Okay, I was about maybe 10, 11 years old. I was in the kitchen with my mother, and then she starts talking to me about this uncle that I didn't know about, her brother, right? And says, what's this? And it turns out it was during World War II in Shanghai. And her brother contracted tuberculosis, TB. And they had a German doctor come over and said, oh, he has TB, you know, but you have to get the drugs. I have no drugs. It's very hard. It was very hard to get materials during that time. And as a result, he died. And it wasn't because the drugs weren't available, but they were just too costly. And even though our family was not poor, we still couldn't get it because of the cost. And it's a very sad situation. And it's really funny because hearing my mother talk about it, she just resigned herself to the fact that sometimes you can't afford treatments that can save lives. Right? And that left an impression on me because I see the way the drug industry is going now with the cost of drugs escalating. And I'm thinking, are we regressing in time? We're getting to a point where drugs are available, but people can't afford them. And how do we get this way? Right. And so a lot of times you end up with people like this, right? And this is what you see in the popular press. You see Martin Shkreli, and you know he's not even a pharmaceutical guy. He's a hedge fund manager. He found a way to get a drug company who has the world supply of generic drug for a certain disease, and he realized that he had a corner in the market, and he just upped the price. He bought out the company, just upped the price. A very shrewd business move, and if you're amoral, that's what you should do. There's no law against this. Ethically, not so good. And then, you know, Elizabeth Holmes, right? Selling vaporware, saying you had a machine that can do diagnostics when the machine never existed. And then going on the road and then raising, you know, almost $1 billion. Her net worth was $9 billion, you know, to the investors. And it's really interesting, when the fraud was exposed, she went to zero in very, very short order. And now she might go to jail, actually. And these are the bad actors. And the problem is the press focuses on this, and they think this is what's wrong with the pharmaceutical industry. And it's actually a lot more nuanced than this. Yes, these are bad actors, but they don't represent what the pharma industry is actually about. And there are headwinds in the pharmaceutical industry that would give us pause, and this is just the tip of the iceberg. Let me just give you an introduction to myself. I've been in biotech for about 27 years here in the Boston area, and I've been through many different companies. I change companies every once in a while just because of the economics of biotech. You know, they go out of business, you know, very quickly, or they get bought out. And if you're in research, in both cases, you get laid off no matter what, right? If you're successful, they go clinical and you're off. But you know, if your company fails, then you're out again anyway. But the good thing is that it exposes you to many, many facets of the biotech industry that you might not have if you were just watching the news. And I've been in, like I said, about 7 companies, ranging from startups, which have been many, to big pharma, which I'm at now, and education, you know, Berkeley, University of Illinois, and then Harvard postdoc. So I have some experience, and in terms of work experience, in terms of just the science itself, all the popular fads in biotech I've lived through in one company or another. So that ranges from regenerative medicine, or ES cell biology, and I was looking at mouse embryonic stem cells, not human. And that's when the field certainly, you know, took off in the early 90s, and the human embryonic stem cells weren't even invented yet. I was involved with human genomics and molecular immunology, checkpoint inhibitors, you know, all this list of exotic technologies that were going to change the world. And, you know, some have and most have not. And that's just the science part. Because I've been in biotech, I have a business component to me, too. So in that sense, I've started companies before. You know, I've operated them, part owner. I've done sales, marketing, due diligence, business strategy, and currently I'm at Takeda, but I'm not speaking today from a Takeda point of view. This is my own personal view. So right now, I'm in a big pharma. Takeda's the Japan's largest pharmaceutical company, and I lead a group that's looking at materials and innovation. Now, one thing that people in the industry, it's like this secret that people in the industry, they know about, but people outside the industry, sometimes they don't realize. And this is actually a continuation of the talk that you heard last night. The talk last night went all the way from discovery to maybe someday using it in the clinic. Here I'm talking about how you get those discoveries and bring it through, right? And the economics are staggering. And this is the thing that really is the scariest part. In the 50s, this is how many drugs you can make for $1 billion. In the 50s, it was maybe 20 or 30, right? And somewhere in the mid-2000s, it was $1 billion to make one drug. And now you can't even do that. Now it takes about, last night, it was, the slide said 2.6. As of today, it's $2.8 billion. $2.8 billion to make a single drug, factoring in all the failures along the way. That means 0.3 drugs for $1 billion. And this simply is not sustainable. And in fact, in the industry, people call it Moore's Law backwards. It's EROM's Law. And the half-life is every 9 years, right? So it's bad. It's log scale, right? And sometimes I tell people, there's a bright side to this, though. There's a silver lining. If you're a mathematician, you see, it's a log scale, so it can never go to zero. All right. And, you know, okay, so what's going on here, right? And so when people talk about drug prices, well, it costs $3 billion to make a drug. So how much money do you think you need to make to, you know, cover your costs? $3 billion at least. And they want to make profit off of that too. So how do you do it? And what's wrong? Why does it cost so much money? And this is the reason. Phase 1 clinical trial, phase 2, phase 3, and this is the probability of success. And it's basically flatlined for the past 20-some-odd years. And despite the genomics revolution, the proteomics revolution, and all these other fancy technologies that's escalated the price of discovery, right, it has not made a dent in probability of success for any clinical trial. Overall, it's been about 10%, even in the last, between 2012 and 2014, the last time this thing was made, right? So we can always look forward to the future, thinking new platforms will be coming in that will save the industry. But so far, that has not happened. And this is an industry in crisis, and it could end. I mean, just be perfectly honest, this could end. And when you talk to business executives in pharma and biotech, and you say these words that this industry might not recover, they'll agree with you. I don't want it to end because this is my job, right? But still, you see this, and you say, well, what do we do? What do we do? Right? And so here's the problem, and here's the major disconnect with the general population, sometimes people who are interested in pharmaceuticals, but they say, well, we'll just innovate. Well, a lot of people use the word innovation without having any clue what innovation really means. And usually the models they take are from a different industry. And so, for example, people know about Clayton Christensen, right? And he's a professor at Harvard. He wrote this very influential book called Innovator's Dilemma. And there, he talks about disruptive innovation. And so when people talk about innovation, they're always talking about this. Basically, if you have a product, you know, let's say, you know, a widget, you spend a lot of time and investment before it actually pays off. And all of a sudden, it becomes commercially advantageous to have it. And you make money, and the market just booms. Eventually, it saturates. So pencils, lawnmowers, you know, common things, they reach a stage of no more competitive advantage. It doesn't matter how much money you put in, it just flatlines, right? Of course, what happens is then a new technology comes in that at first is inferior, but with added time, it actually gets better than the old technology, and it takes it to a place where the old technology could not take it. And that becomes the new standard, and that flatlines. Now, the easiest example for you to see this is how about laptops and iPhone? Or how about digital cameras and iPhone? Huh? Or how about GPS and iPhone, right? clear as day, right? So that is the nature of innovation. When you talk to anyone on the street, this, even though they can't articulate this or might not have thought about it that much, this is what they think of. And so they say, well, can't pharma do this? Well, the unfortunate thing is that, you know, pharmaceutical companies or the FDA does not allow this, all right? This model is for tech industry not for pharma. In pharma, if you have a medicine for disease, right, and it's the established standard of care, you can't come in with an inferior pill and say, well, I'll just work on it and eventually be better. It doesn't work that way. You come in and it's inferior, you're gone, you're bankrupt instantly. Like overnight, you're bankrupt, right? So it's in pharma, all you have is this. You're always incrementally better unless you come up with a new platform that completely changes the paradigm. And that's what everybody's looking for. Hasn't happened yet. The costs are still going up, right, even as we speak. And so as a result, what we're seeing here and what explains that EROM's law is a saturation of technical improvement. Even though you can throw more technology in, you're not getting any more back, right? And so what people then do is say, okay, granted, maybe sometimes you have a disease that's saturated. You can't, for the cost of developing a new drug, it's not worth the investment. Let's go for either unmet medical needs or rare diseases, right? Because in those cases, the playing field hasn't, hit this inflection point yet. And maybe we have a chance to make some profit here. And so everyone runs toward this area. Or you can just exit the field and just make generics. That's the other way of doing it. In which case, you're out of this game. You're not into the discovery space anymore, right? So everyone's looking for something orthogonal, some hit that will come, all right? But you see, there's a problem here. And the problem is that this is driven by desperation. There are people who are sick, right? And in this ecosystem, you have the inventor. Now, we realize that we live in a fallen world, right? Out there, people are not all Christians, right? And the people who are leaders of industries are not all Christian. They have their own motives for things. So, for example, a lot of these inventors, right, they're in it for fame and ego. I mean, they want to be a renowned professor or an innovator, inventor in a company, and they want to be recognized as such and have their chapter in a book written about them sometime in the future. And they're the ones who maybe have the original observation. But they're never going to take this to clinic. That's not going to happen. You need some financiers in the middle, like venture capitalists. Right? And these venture capitalists, they're looking for things that can have a 6x return, 10x return, 100x return. And they don't care if you're making a drug or washing machines, because they're being funded by their limited partners, who are just wealthy people who want their money escalated. So they're in it just to accelerate this discovery so it looks good to the pharma companies, right? And the pharma companies, of course, you have executives with egos as well, too, but they need, products that make at least $1 billion a year to offset all their losses in their discovery process. Now, how are they going to do this, right? And why do they need to do this, too? Well, at the end of it, it's the stockholders in their company with the new mutual funds. They buy shares of Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer, right? They have to be satisfied that the company's growing. And so they have this pressure of making drugs that sell and are profitable. If they're not profitable, all this goes away and the whole ecosystem collapses. So even though you think that it's the pharmaceutical companies that might be evil, actually, we're all part of it. If we have a retirement account, we're part of this whole thing. And it all rests on the backs of the patient. It's all for the patient. These are brutal things to say. When I go give public talks about it, it's difficult. But we need to have a dialogue to understand where we're coming from. Now, people who are true CEOs of companies, like this is Len Schaefer, and he's the CEO of Regeneron. It's a very famous biotech company. And he recently blasted the CEO of Pfizer for being too greedy in their prices, right? And you should check this out. It's Matt Herper. He has a little blog, and he writes about this. And in public, he's trashing the Pfizer CEO. He doesn't deserve a share of the GDP just for his drugs, right? But yet, at the same time, Regeneron, which is a very profitable company, sells two drugs. And their Eylea drug is $11,000 a year for treatment, and the Dupixent is $37,000 a year. So even though he's blasting other people for having high-priced drugs, his own company are producing high-priced drugs. And in this article, he blames the insurance companies. Well, why aren't they insuring 100% or something close to affordable for the patients? And of course, the insurance companies said, we can't do that because our system, our economics, we can't afford that. And so there's a balance. So there's a fight between the pharmas and the payers, the insurance companies as well, too. So it gets very, very complex. And you can see where all this is going. This high price of drugs is from how much it costs to actually make a drug these days, plus a lot of headwinds, a lot of bad actors. It's this one big mess that's going on in the pharma industry. And here's an idea. This came from MIT, Technology Review. And this is an interesting graphic on how much, you know, some of these most exotic medications that are coming out are costing, right? And yes, you would say that gene therapy and immuno-oncology and all these CAR T cells, they're really fantastic game changers, but at what cost? So right now, the only marketed gene therapy is Glybera, $1 million a dose. $1 million, right? And this one, this is also gene therapy. This is for eye diseases, right? It's up there, about 900,000 or so, right? And also, the little dot is how large the market size, how many patients these things actually treat. So Glybera, they made a drug that treats less than 10 people. That's why they're $1 million apiece, right? And this one treats maybe 30 patients a year. And so you have these other ones, and the CAR T cells like this, right? Even though the price for these guys are in the $400,000 range, if you include the hospitalization, these are also $1 million of treatment. And I've heard like VCs actually come out and say, but this is worth it, these are saving a life. But at what cost is the industry going to bear this? And I think that's a major, major problem. It's a conundrum. Nobody wants it this way. Nobody wants bad actors. Nobody wants high-priced drugs. But if this is what it's led to, at some point, this industry just may collapse. All right? We should just be aware of this, right? I don't want it to collapse. You know, I hope that, you know, we'll find a new platform and it'll usher in a new age of medicine. And I've seen many of these things come through, like, you know, combinational chemistry, genomics, proteomics, you know, RNA. Now it's AI and immuno-oncology. Something here will save the field and bring the price down. But as far as I see it, it's actually driving the cost of drug discovery up. Right. Now, unless you have a hit, and maybe you have a series of hits, something can change. Let's hope for the best. If that doesn't happen, what does the future look like? Right. Well, failing pipelines, right, will lead to industry mergers. Just like the chemical companies, there used to be many of them, and they all consolidated because they couldn't support a pipeline. Right. And so the rate of new drugs for invention will just fall until there's only a few big players left. Maybe at the end of the day, it's only Sanofi and Pfizer, the two biggest ones left. Kind of like how Dow is one of the last chemical companies left, the big ones, right? Also, if FDA and government regulation continues to increase with the number of bars you have to jump through in order to get a drug approved, that's going to be devastating too. And human testing and drug discovery might just go overseas, maybe to a third world country, second world countries, where the restrictions are much less. Probably not the way you want things to be, because, you know, the standards for the care might not be as good in their clinical trials, but it could happen. I mean, biotechs, a lot of them, I've been in many, that won't do a clinical trial in the United States because it's too expensive. So they go to third world countries. They go to Mexico and, you know, places like Russia, right, where they can get some proof of concept data in a lower cost country. Not the best way to do, but when you're forced against the wall and you don't have the money, this is what happens. My favorite, you know, what I think is going to happen is that the need for medical therapies is going to exist. That's the delta G for us. There's always going to be sick people. We should care for them. Everybody understands that. And, And what I think, you know, what happens is, just because you need medical care, does it mean you have to have drug discovery? Or could it be something else, right? How about drug delivery systems, right? Instead of inventing a new drug, use an old drug that's more precise in delivery. I like that. Medical devices, many medical devices out there. We've heard, you know, some talks this morning about potential new medical devices that can be used, right? And other technologies that come out. I really like focused ultrasound. You know, I like a lot of things that are, you know, like radiation therapy. Those are becoming much more precise as well, too. Is the future going to be technology-based rather than medicine-based? Of course, the medicines don't go away. It just saturates. And you end up with the armamentarium that you have now for medication, but new ones will be very difficult to come by. Okay. And so,
would you be willing to take questions soon?
Yeah. Okay, so this is one of the last slides here anyway. All right. And so, just remember, like, pharma industry, it's not all bad, but it is fallen, right? And they're not a philanthropy, right? But they do have corporate social responsibility, and they have access to medicine programs. So they try to balance it out, but they have to make money. And unfortunately, you know, bad actors in this field, they do go very far. And you will find them when you start going into this field, right? And so you're talking about executives who are only in it for the money, venture capitalists, and you know, money, power, fame people. You know, it's all in there. And the higher up you go, the more of these people that you encounter. It's just one of those things. So what do you do, right, as a Christian? Well, I take my inspiration from Paul in Corinthians, right? So to the Jews, I am a Jew. To those like under the law, I become like one under the law, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I have become all things to all people so that by all possible means I might save some. And intrinsically, I think you understand this. We have to walk our Christian life. We have to do what we can. We have to help the people along the way that we interact with. This system is much bigger than one individual. Can we be a spark of light? But one thing I really like, though, is that you got to be able to talk to people. So it's not like, you know, to the Jew, I'm a Gentile. To the Gentile, I'm a Jew. He's saying that you've got to talk one-on-one to the people that you're interacting with and get along with them. And by that, maybe you can hope to spread the gospel a little bit. Thank you very much.
So we can take a few questions.
My question has to do with not putting new drugs on the market, but the accelerated expense of existing drugs. You know, there's examples of drugs that have been on the market for a long time, and yet their price increases outstripping significantly, just inflationary expenses. So what's driving the accelerating costs of already existing medications?
There's a lot of market dynamics, right? So when you talk to business development people in closed rooms, they always think about what's the maximal amount of money you can charge for a medication, right? That's just business principles. Of course, it costs about a nickel to make a pill. For biologics and injectables, it's a little bit more, actually it's a lot more expensive. But for pills, it's about a nickel, right? And when it goes generic, that's why a lot of the big pharmas, they give up on their small molecule, you know, tablets, right? Because other companies from India and low-cost third world countries can produce those. So the thing to drive down the price of drugs, right, is for it to become generic. Yes, that's right. So it's interesting. As a pharmaceutical company, you are confronted with different price controls for different countries. There are some countries where the government will not allow drugs to be, overpriced for their population. And unless you sell them at this pre-negotiated price with the government, you just won't be allowed to gain entry. So, for example, the UK, they have this NICE, which is this committee that determines, depending on how much a person has left to live and the quality of life they have, how much that patient is worth in terms of cost of medication. And they go from that to allow what the maximum cost of a drug can be. Yeah, so Europe is much more regulated. The United States is not so much regulated. It's more ethics bound. But someday it's going to happen here too, right? Because it's the costs really are unbearable. You're right.
We could take one last question.
Mark Strand, North Coast State University. In terms of the Christian response to this dilemma, is there also a role for the Christian to be speaking prophetically in terms of a demand for social justice and the concerns of the poor, as opposed to just kind of supporting a market approach to allow the pharmaceutical industry to continue to just increase profits?
Right. So I think, there are two parts of that. Yes, I mean, as a Christian, the morality is that we want to have the best care available. I mean, that's one of Christ's mandate, right, to heal the sick, right? So that I totally agree with. And that's where people have access to medicines and, you know, the corporate social responsibility, so political action groups can petition companies to give out drugs for free for the people who can't afford it. So those programs do exist. And so I think, you know, that's the way that social activism can work with pharmaceutical companies. But to me, it's bigger than that, right? Because eventually, if you can't make at least $3 billion off of a drug, you can't make it. That's the problem. And so if that is not attainable, the industry would collapse, right? It's just inevitable. And then it would be a different world. I wouldn't say there's not going to be any more medical therapy, but it's going to be a different world that we live in.
Thank you, Vincent Long. Our next presentation will be in about 3 minutes.